peeking around the outer wall of the chalet, he jumped to his feet and ran.
56.
The first thing Harvath needed to do was to stop his bleeding. The next was to get the hell out of Dodge, Vengen, whatever. The village was situated on what the Swiss call the Vengen Sun Terrace, a long westward-facing plateau that got fabulous sun in the afternoon. That was definitely the case today. Quickly and carefully, Harvath picked his way from chalet to chalet, trying to stay concealed as best as was possible in the blazing sunshine. He made a makeshift pressure bandage from his windbreaker so he wouldn't leave a trail of blood for the remaining two gunmen to follow. Seven chalets later, Harvath came upon a restaurant that was blaring techno music. This was definitely a snowboarder hangout. Scott scanned the crowd of young faces, hoping to find his little blonde girlfriend with the nose ring and her friends. They would be perfect cover, but they were nowhere to be seen. Scott needed to come up with another plan. Snowboarding was an interesting sport in that it offered a high probability for wipeouts, and wiping out in the strong sunshine meant that the snow you picked up melted quickly, and even the most waterproof of snowboarding outfits got wet. A leafless tree on the side of the restaurant had become the snowboarder's communal coat rack. Why these kids never took them inside or out onto the terraces with them to dry out was beyond him, but right now, Harvath was grateful for it. He found a drab brown and gray coat that looked as though it would fit, and chose a good-sized black helmet from the pile, so neatly arranged at the base of the tree. A couple of people would be very angry to find their gear had been stolen, but at least Harvath might have a better chance at survival. Walking away from the restaurant, he also grabbed the last snowboard in the line leaning against the wall. He put the jacket on and found there was a pair of goggles in the pocket, which he put on along with the helmet. Quickly, he made his way toward the Menlischen gondola. The pain in his arm was almost unbearable. He didn't think he had any arterial damage, but he needed to get a better look at the wound. If he wasn't careful, he could risk bleeding to death. Spotting a busy pizzeria, he ducked inside and went downstairs to the men's room. Taking off the coat, he saw the windbreaker pressure bandage was stained with blood. Untying the knotted sleeves, Scott braced himself for a gush of blood. The bullet had nailed him pretty good, but it hadn't penetrated an artery. A fraction more to one side, and he would have been in real trouble. He checked the injury over thoroughly and realized it was a serious grazing wound and would definitely need stitches, but that should take care of it. Harvath's belt was made of woven black leather, the type whose buckle can be placed anywhere. He removed it from his cargo pants and quickly wrapped it around the upper section of his left arm, pulling the belt tight, his eyes pinched shut in response to the pain. He looked at his watch and marked when he would need to release the tourniquet. He covered his arm with the bloody windbreaker, hoping to prevent any blood from seeping outside of the jacket, cleaned his hands as best he could, and left the restaurant. With a snowboard under his right arm, the jacket zipped all the way up, and the helmet and the goggles on, Harvath had his best disguise yet. He moved as fast as his legs would carry him to the gondola and watched for signs of his attackers. Before getting on board, he bought a hot dog and a couple of cans of Red Bull energy drink. He needed to build his strength back up. A gondola operator pointed at the no eating, no drinking sign.
"You've got to be kidding me," said an exasperated Harvath.
The operator wasn't kidding.
"I've been shot at, trampled, chased by goats, shot at again, and this guy's worried about me eating in his precious gondola? What a day," he thought to himself.
After two fast bites of the hot dog, Scott threw the rest of it out and slid the Red Bull into his pocket. As the gondola drew up the mountain, Harvath stood facing the back and watched Vengen slowly recede in front of him. He had made it. He was safe. But for how long? Once at the top of the Menlischen, it was a short but painful walk to the Grindelwald gondola that took him back into the village he'd been in only hours before. The only way down from Grindelwald was the train to Wilderswiel. He watched the station carefully, letting two trains go before he decided to get on board. In the station's bathroom, he had released the tourniquet for a moment of precious relief. The fingers of his left hand had gone numb half an hour ago. In Wilderswil, he caught the bus to Interlaken's Centralplatz, where he found a payphone and called Balmer's. He told Jackie where he was, that he was hurt, and needed her to pick him up. The weight of the snowboard helmet threatened to crush his neck. He was lightheaded, his legs were like rubber bands, and his stomach was churning. He stayed in the phone booth, leaning against the side, until Jackie arrived, 20 minutes later. 57.
"You look like shit,"
was the first thing Jackie said, as Scott eased himself into the passenger seat.
"And a gentle bonsoir to you as well, fair lady. Hey, I'm not auditioning for the Chippendales here. I'm hurt. Did you bring the things I asked for?"
"Yes, but I don't have any experience in this stuff."
"Didn't you take that wilderness medicine course in Utah when we all used to go backcountry skiing?"
"Yeah, but that was years ago."
"I'll guide you through it step by step."
"Scott, I don't think I..."
"Jackie, if I could go to a doctor, I would. But the doctor would ask questions and would probably want to invite the police to take a look. I can't afford that. You have to do this for me."
He closed his eyes, and they drove the rest of the way in silence. In Scott's room, Jackie produced a small bag that contained everything he had asked for. The guys who ran Jackie's adventure sports desk, with canyoning, bungee, and rafting trips in the summer, had left behind what they joked was their Rambo first aid kit. One of them, an American named Tony, was a certified EMT, and his partner Paul had been a registered nurse. There wasn't much these two couldn't handle out in the field, and the kit reflected that. Inside Jackie's bag, which she had dumped onto the bed, was the first aid kit, a bottle of hydrogen peroxide, gauze, and clean bandages. Scott groaned as he took off the stolen jacket. Jackie gasped when she saw his entire left side caked with blood.
"What the hell happened to you? And don't tell me you cut yourself shaving."
"I cut myself shaving."
"Do you want my help or not?"
"I was shot."
"Shot? I thought no one knew you were here."
"Either that or it's open season on anyone with a bad dye job."
"But who in Switzerland would want to shoot you?"
"Jackie, I'm a little bit under the weather at the moment. Can we play 50 questions later?"
"Of course. I'm sorry. What do you want me to do?"
"First, let's get this windbreaker off."
As Jackie helped him, Scott continued talking.
"Now, take the scissors out of the first aid kit, and starting at my cuff, I need you to cut the sweater all the way up to where the tourniquet is, and then do the same with the shirt underneath."
Jackie did as she was told.
"Do me a favor and hand me that towel over there so I can use it as a compress."
"Thanks."
"Now, when we release the tourniquet, there might be some more blood, so I want you to be ready. Are you going to be okay? You're not going to go south on me, are you?"
She shook her head, a few stray wisps of auburn falling into her eyes, which she quickly brushed away.
"All right. Take the needle that looks like a curved half moon and the coil of black silk out of the kit."
"I got it. I suppose I thread it the same way I would a regular needle and thread?"
"It should already be threaded."
"It's not."
"Great. Just thread it like a regular needle and go to town. We don't have time to learn how to do surgical knots."
Jackie threaded the needle while Scott continued his directions.
"Now, when I release the tourniquet, I want you to tear my sweater and shirt the rest of the way up to my shoulder. I'll hold the compress on the wound to stop any bleeding. As soon as you have my sleeve out of the way, I'll pull back the compress and you dump the hydrogen peroxide straight into the wound."
"How much should I use?"
"Pour a little on the needle right now, and then pour about half the bottle onto my arm."
"That's going to hurt."
"No, you think?" "Listen, Jack, I don't really have any choice. Are you ready?"
When Jackie nodded, Scott released the tourniquet and let the belt fall to the bed. He placed the clean towel against his arm as Jackie used both hands to tear his sleeves up to the collar. When he saw the peroxide in her hand, he pulled back the compress. The blood flow was not as bad as he'd thought it might be. With a quick look at Jackie to signal he was ready, Scott steeled himself for the pain. When she poured the peroxide into the gash in his arm, The stew of blood and ripped flesh began to bubble and turn a mucus-looking white. Jackie felt queasy, but didn't stop until half the bottle had been emptied. The peroxide ran down Scott's arm and stomach, covering his pants and dripping onto the bed. It felt like hot acid, and he clenched his jaw with a force that was 1 foot-pound of pressure short of cracking his teeth and sending his fillings flying across the room. When Jackie set the bottle on the nightstand, Scott relaxed his bite and gave her his next instructions.
Now you need to stitch me up.
Oh, Scott, I don't know if I can do that.
You've got to, Jackie. Just grab the needle and start from the top.
But what if I don't do it right?
He didn't have the strength or the patience to argue with her. He did his best to stay calm.
You'll do fine. Come on, start here and work your way down. We'll make sure you draw the folds together as evenly as possible.
It's going to hurt.
You're such a kidder. That's what you said about the peroxide, and I was fine, he lied. Let's go.
15 minutes later, it was done. The stitches were clean, and although there would probably be a scar, it could have been much worse.
I think you missed your calling, said Scott.
What do you mean?
You should have been a surgeon. These are very clean. I thought you were going to leave me looking like Frankenstein.
Very funny. Now hold still while I put this bandage on.
This time, it was Scott who accepted the orders and did as he was told.
There, that should do it. I'm sorry, I don't have any antibiotic ointment.
That's okay, said Scott. The peroxide should kill just about anything that might have gotten in there.
Is there a high risk of infection?
Well, the bullet wound, there always is. But I think we cleaned it out pretty well.
Good. Are you hungry? Can I get you some soup or something?
I would love some soup, but we need to talk first.
She gathered up the equipment and set it on the table.
I'm all ears.
Jackie, you have been a real sweetheart. You've really helped me out.
You don't have to thank me.
Yes, I do. Not just for sewing me up, but for everything else.
Don't worry, I told you I would put it all on your bill. By the way, critical care is very expensive in Switzerland.
Scott smiled.
I'm sure it is. Listen, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I'm starting to get a better picture. I need to ask you another favor.
Another favor?
Sure, why not? What can I do for you? Take your appendix out?
No, said Scott, laughing. Nothing that serious. I need to borrow your car.
Okay, but the smokescreen and the oil slick have been on the fritz. Every time I take it in to be fixed, the mechanic says he's got it working, and then as soon as I get it home and need to wipe out some bad guys, it doesn't work again. It's also not bulletproof, you know.
That's okay. I don't intend to get it or myself near any more bullets.
Jackie gave him a stern glance, knowing he was lying.
Why don't I believe you?
I just need it for tonight, and...
Not a chance.
Why?
Scott, I don't care how much of a macho guy you think you are. You could barely make it up the stairs a short while ago. I practically had to carry you the whole way. You are in no condition to drive.
I was exhausted. Being shot at has a funny way of doing that to you. It's kind of been a bad day.
All the more reason you shouldn't be behind the wheel.
Okay, you're right. I'll make you a deal. Bring up some soup, I'll eat, get a little sleep, and then I'll go.
She sat on the edge of the bed, not saying anything. She just gave him the same disbelieving look.
Come on, Jack, Scout's honor, I promise. I wouldn't ask you if it wasn't important.
Okay, I'll do it, but on one condition.
What is it?
I want a straight answer.
Okay.
What's happening?
Jackie, if I knew, I would tell you. I mean that straight.
So you have no idea who tried to kill you today, or how they found you?
None at all.
Once again, Scott was lying. He did have the beginnings of an idea, but nothing concrete.
Scott, someone knows you're here. This is serious. I'm worried about you. It was one thing when you told me everything was going on back in the States, but whatever this trouble is, it's followed you here. We should get you help.
No, no help, Jack. I can handle this.
Scott, I know someone I think can help you.
Jackie, I mean it. No help. I can get myself out of this.
Before or after you get shot at again?
What are you talking about, this? He asked, motioning to his bandaged arm. It's just a flesh wound. I'll bite the legs off of anyone who tries anything else.
Monty Python, very funny. I mean it. You need help.
Actually, what I need is some soup, and then a short nap. Everything will be fine. You'll see.
I wish I could believe you.
Jackie left the room and returned 20 minutes later carrying a tray with rolls, butter, soup, and a dish of ice cream.
The car will be parked next to the bakery, 2 blocks down.
I'll leave the keys under the mat, she said.
Thanks.
Promise me you'll be careful.
I promise.
I'm worried about you, Scott.
Me too, Jack. Me too.
58. When Scott awoke several hours later, he was surprised that he had actually fallen asleep. He was also surprised at the depth of his exhaustion. Apparently, Jackie had come to collect his tray, and he hadn't even heard her. Sleeping that soundly was dangerous. Scott looked at his watch and realized he needed to get going. He had a long drive ahead of him. There was no blood seeping through the bandage, but his arm was still in a lot of pain, as was his head. He pulled a couple of Tylenols from his shaving kit and chased them with the last of the mineral water. Next, he got out the glue and applied the bushy brown eyebrows and goatee. With a towel across his lap in case he dropped a lens, he sat on the edge of the bed and put the brown contacts in. Then, he slipped on the thin wire-frame glasses. Harvath looked in the mirror, staring at the contrast between the brown eyebrows and goatee and his stark blonde, almost white hair. Thank goodness it was cold, and he would be able to wear a hat. With his good right arm, he slowly slid into a pair of khakis, but putting on a button-down shirt was murder. The pain surged through his arm and into his shoulder.
Slowly, he told himself. Take it slowly.
30 minutes later, disguised as Hans Browner, Harvath left Balmer's and made his way toward the bakery. The car was exactly where Jackie had said she would leave it. The keys were under the mat, and there was a post-it note on the knob of the gear shift that read simply, "Be careful." Harvath chided himself again for ever letting her go. Despite the cold, the car turned over immediately. Scott signaled and merged into the flow of Saturday evening Interlaken traffic. The drive to Munich was long, yet thankfully uneventful. At the border, sleepy guards, anxious to get off duty, waved him on through when he held up his German passport. Harvath followed the signs toward München Flughafen. Driving in Europe was so much easier than in America. The routes were perfectly marked with easy-to-understand signs, and as long as you stayed out of Italy, the drivers were courteous and knew what they were doing. He parked his car at the Munich airport, long-term lot, and caught a train for the short ride to the Hauptbahnhof. Even though it was late, the city's main train station was alive with activity. There were the requisite homeless people hitting up passers-by for spare change, a heaping helping of drunk students, some with large packs, waiting for their trains, as well as a smattering of locals with the wide smiles and hearty laughter that the people of this city had been known for ever since Augustiner monks introduced beer to the city over 600 years ago. Not counting Oktoberfest, it was said that the average Münchener consumed at least 220 liters of beer a year, more than twice the average amount drunk in the rest of Germany. The Bavarians were a hearty bunch, there was no denying that. Outside the station on the Bayerstrasse, Harvath caught a cab and gave the driver the address he wanted on Pfisterstrasse, not far from the Max-Josef-Platz. When the cab pulled up, the wooden blinds of the establishment were shut tight. The driver made a comment about the café looking closed, but Harvath paid him and got out. It was after 1 a.m., and the Kunstcafé was indeed closed, or at least that's the message its proprietor wanted to send to anyone casually strolling by, hoping to pop in for a quick bite or one last drink. Behind the blinds, the lights were still blazing, and Scott heard a mill of voices. Somewhere inside, a piano sprang to life, and a beautiful tenor voice began to belt out a song. The singing continued as Scott went around to the back of the small cafe. He peeled off his hat and the pieces of his disguise, then placed all of it in his jacket pocket, Garbage was piled high in the alley, and maneuvering around a stack of bright blue and yellow plastic beer crates filled with empty bottles, Harvath found the back door. He knew that if Herman was entertaining, he probably would still have staff on duty. As Harvath entered the kitchen, he surprised two rather stocky waiters. Before they could say anything, Herman's cook, Frederick, turned and saw Scott standing in the doorway. Instantly, his eyes lit up in recognition, and a broad smile crept across his face. Harvath put a finger to his lips to silence the cook, who in return gave him the thumbs up and pointed toward the front of the cafe. After all, what good was surprising an old friend if you couldn't really surprise him? Herman was still singing and had his back to Scott as he emerged from behind a beaded curtain down the hall from the kitchen. Herman's thick fingers crashed upon the last keys, and the small group collected in the front of the cafe clapped enthusiastically. When they stopped, one pair of hands was still clapping.
"Lovely. Simply lovely," said Scott.
Herman looked up in the direction of the voice and then roared, "First, I'm going to fire the cook, and then I'm going to get the lock on that back door fixed." His guests sat speechless. Who was this man standing at the end of the bar, and why was their host yelling at him in English? It was amazing how quickly Herman moved his 6'4", 240-pound frame around the piano and over to Harvath. The limp from his injured leg didn't slow him down at all. Herman's huge hands reached out, and Scott almost flinched as he saw them close in on his face. The beefy German gave him a kiss on each cheek and then raised Harvath completely off the floor in an enormous bear hug. The pain in his shoulder was written across his face, and Herman noticed. Quickly, he set his friend back on the floor.
"What's wrong with you? Are you hurt?" said Herman. "Did your hairdresser beat you up when you refused to pay for that awful hairstyle?"
"We need to talk. I'm sorry to interrupt your little party."
"Party? This? Don't worry. They'll only stay as long as I keep the bar open. And the bar is now closed," shouted Herman, who turned to the group and told them in German to settle up their tabs.
After the group left, Herman had the cook make them each up a plate of Würstel with potatoes and sauerkraut, then sent the staff home. Herman set two large bottles of beer on the table and said,
"It's great to see you. Why don't I call Diana? She's probably asleep by now, but it doesn't matter. She would love to see you, even with your hair like that."
Scott responded as Herman drew a small cellular telephone from his breast pocket.
"You know what? For now, let's not tell Diana I'm here. I need to talk to you alone."
Herman replaced the phone in his pocket.
"Does this have anything to do with the face you made when I gave you the hug?"
"Kind of."
"You're getting soft. Look at me,"
said Herman, flexing his right biceps and then slamming his hands upon his midsection.
"I'm still in better shape than most men my age, and I run a cafe now for a living. All this food, all this beer, and I haven't put on more than 2 kilos, 3 max.
Scott smiled.
"You look great, Herman, and I'm sure Deanna does too. You will have to tell her that I asked about her."
"What do you mean? You can tell her yourself. After we eat, we go back to my place. You can have the guest room."
"I'm sorry. I can't stay that long. I just came because I need some information and a favor."
Herman's jovial expression turned quietly serious.
"Are you in some sort of trouble?"
"Actually, my friend, I'm in many sorts of trouble."
Harvath brought Herman up to speed on everything that had happened to him. Herman listened intently, only picking at the plate of food in front of him. When Scott finished, Herman took a long swallow from his beer and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand before responding.
"So, what is it you need from me?"
"Like I said, information. I thought all of the shooters yesterday were working together until I heard the American voices and realized that there were probably 2 groups. The first, with the woman, must have been gunning for me because of the note I sent to the post office box in Interlaken. And the second was the hit team from D.C., who somehow managed to pick up my trail."
"Okay. 2 separate groups, then. But why?"
"I have an idea who is behind the American team, but not the team from the ice palace at the Jungfraujoch. That team spoke German."
"You said that. You also said it didn't sound like German-German, right?"
"It sounded like Swiss-German. But it was only a couple of words. That's pretty hard to nail an accent with.
Let's assume for a moment that you're correct on the accent. You said they also spoke Serbian?
Yes, that I'm certain of.
Herman leaned backward in his chair. He appeared to be staring at the ceiling, studying the wine-colored tiles that ran between the old wooden beams. Harvath knew what he was thinking, turning something over in his mind.
You are absolutely certain that your FBI and the rest of the U.S. government is wrong about Fatah?
I don't know. I do know there is no way the Fatah, if they are even involved, could have pulled off something like this on their own. We can be sure they had inside help from people within my government.
And you're positive that you're on the correct path?
Positive? I don't think anyone can be positive on something like this. All I know is that somebody else thinks I'm on the right path.
What do you mean, somebody else thinks?
I think the attempts on my life, two of them just yesterday in Switzerland, make for a pretty strong case that I'm onto something.
I agree. I also agree that this entire situation does not seem to fit the Fatah. Someone is using them as some sort of smokescreen.
So, if we're on the same page, who do you think would be capable of an attack like this and kidnapping the president?
You're right that it would have to be undertaken by a group with exceptional mountaineering and military skills. They could have come from Germany, or like you said, France, Italy, Austria, or...
Or?
You are sure that what you heard in the Ice Palace was two men, the same who had been shooting at you, speaking Serbian?
It's one of the few things in this whole mess that I'm totally positive about.
Then that narrows the field considerably.
59.
What the hell happened?
Yelled Senator Snyder into the scramble phone in his study, as Senator Rolander looked on.
We acquired the target, but there was another interested party already present, replied the hired killer.
Another interested party? Who were they?
We have no idea. They made their move before we had a chance, so we hung back.
What happened? Asked Rolander.
Snyder cupped the mouthpiece and addressed Rolander.
The girl led the team right to him, but someone else made a move before they had a chance to take him out.
Shit. Then they know about him?
They must know something, said Snyder, as he turned his attention back to the phone. What happened then?
The target evaded the shooters, and we followed him. When we tried to close out the contract, he managed to get away.
He got away? Maybe I haven't been clear. You and your associates are not being paid for him to get away. You are being paid to take him out. I can't believe this. That's the third time. Harvath must be eliminated.
He will be.
Do you have any idea where he is now?
No, but we're working on it.
What about the girl?
She disappeared.
We had to stick with our target. She shouldn't be too hard to find, though.
She'd better not be. And I'd better not hear about any more failed attempts. You get that slippery son of a bitch and you take him out once and for all. Do you understand me?
The killer didn't have a chance to respond. Snyder had already slammed down the phone.
60.
They rode in silence toward the Munich airport as the long monowiper of Herman's Mercedes beat a steady rhythm against the windshield and the steadily falling snow. Scott was processing the information Herman had spent the last hour sharing with him. When NATO forces had been brought in to keep the peace in Kosovo, it had been divided into several sectors, French, German, Italian, and so forth. Despite the presence of NATO, emotions and tempers on both sides still raged very hot. Serbians had hit lists of Albanians they wanted dead, and vice versa. Much of this involved the ordinary citizenry, but there were also very high-ranking military, political, and business people who had extremely nasty bones to pick with their enemies, but who were being watched so closely that they didn't dare act. Realizing there was a need for their services, a band of highly trained killers put themselves on the market in Yugoslavia. Nothing was beneath them. They had no problem killing, raping, torturing, or maiming men, women, or children. Anyone was fair game, as long as the price was right. What's more, they specialized in assignments that were considered impossible. There was no security system they could not breach, no hiding place that couldn't be uncovered. Once they had your scent, it was said, it was time to make your peace with God.
You're sure the killers were Swiss? Said Harvath, breaking their silence.
And the NATO soldiers acted as go-betweens.
That's what my contact told me. Remember that much like Berlin after World War II, Kosovo was divided into sectors controlled by troops from specific countries. As Swiss, the assassins were fluent in French, German, Italian, and English. They only interacted with the people right below the top of the different military commands, the seconds. These soldiers were hungry for profit, and the killers took very good care of them. If there was an Albanian, a Serb, anyone in their sector that needed a job done, these soldiers arranged it.
Scott had seen it before, and it made him sick.
Those soldiers were there to keep the peace, not to facilitate murders for hire.
What are you Americans so fond of saying? War is hell. Most of the NATO soldiers were risking their lives daily in a country that they hadn't even heard of or thought about since geography class in primary school. Lots of people were getting rich. Why not them? And if a couple of bad guys want to rub each other out, who cares?
I understand the mentality, Herman. I just never agreed with it.
No, but that's not what we're talking about.
You're right. I'm getting away from the point. So, we know that the hired killers were a group of Swiss. Do we know where they were from in Switzerland? Were they military? Police of some sort?
Herman pulled at his large nose.
My contact stated that no one seemed to know where in Switzerland these men were from, or what they looked like. No one knew what their background was, only that they were extremely qualified.
How were they contacted when a hit was to be ordered?
Through a series of dead drops.
What else did your contact tell you?
Apparently, the killers were known as the Lions.
The Lions? Why Lions?
I thought maybe the NATO soldiers gave the name to them to put more of a face on the people they were dealing with. But my contact made it very clear that it was how the killers identified themselves. Just a whisper of the word was enough to send people into hiding.
Can you get any more information about them for me?
I don't think so. The Lions supposedly stopped operating in Yugoslavia and could be dead for all we know.
Dead? They might be, but I doubt it. One thing is for certain, though. If they are alive, and if these are the people I'm looking for, I promise you, they will be dead very soon.
The drive back from Munich was grueling. 20 minutes after Herman dropped Scott at the airport parking lot to retrieve his car and he was on the Autobahn, a deep fatigue had set in. The psychological stress from the past several days and the physical damage to his body both came calling at once. The 2 cans of Red Bull he had with him, and coffees at every other truck stop along his route, kept him going until he got back to Interlaken and could finally drop onto his bed and slide into a deep sleep. It felt as though only 5 minutes had passed before he drifted into a dream about Jackie. He could hear her concern for him in her voice, but for some reason, he could not see her face. She was worried. Should she call a doctor? Was he all right?
There was blood, she said. Not as much as before, but a little.
Are you sure? She asked.
I didn't know what to do. Yes, I do care about him.
Her voice grew louder, but Scott still could not see her. A light shone, and it too grew brighter. As he got closer to Jackie's voice, the light grew in intensity. He found his eyelids opening of their own free will, even though all he wanted to do was sleep. Soon, he was able to see through the light and make out shapes. Jackie's voice was still with him, but where was she? He blinked his eyes through the mist, trying to focus. There was a figure at the end of his bed. The voice continued, but the figure wasn't speaking. The voice was coming from somewhere else. Harvath shut his eyes tightly, trying to clear his vision. When he opened them, he was terrified by what he saw. It was her, the woman from the ice palace. She was sitting at the foot of his bed. Was this a dream? Some sort of hallucination? Out of sheer instinct, he reacted. He rolled to his right and reached for the 9mm Beretta that Herman had given him before saying goodbye last night. His hand fumbled clumsily along the nightstand. It was gone.
But how? He had placed it right there before he went.
"Looking for this?" said the woman, holding up the pistol.
"Or maybe this,"
she said, as she raised the replica Glock. Now Harvath knew he wasn't dreaming.
"Please tell me you didn't carry a toy to the Jungfraujoch yesterday. It will only make me think less of you," said the woman.
Scott was trapped. There was no way he could spring from where he was and get to her before she got a shot off. The situation seemed hopeless. From out of the corner of his left eye, he saw a hand approach his face, and automatically he reached out and grabbed it by the wrist. He twisted it hard.
"Scott, stop it! You're hurting me! It's me, Jackie! It's okay, calm down!"
"Jackie," he said, confused.
"I don't understand. Are you okay?"
"She didn't try to hurt you, did she? If she did, I'll..."
"No, Scott, of course she didn't try to hurt me. I'm okay."
"I was so careful. I thought I'd made sure no one was following me. I must have led them here, Jackie. I'm sorry. I never intended to get you this involved."
"Scott, relax. This is Claudia Mueller. She's a friend of ours."
"What do you mean, she's a friend?" asked Scott warily.
"Rolf and I know her from Bern."
"What's she doing here?"
"I've been worried about you," Jackie said, as she tried again, this time without meeting resistance, to apply a cold compress to Scott's forehead. "I knew you didn't want me to call a doctor, but I didn't know what to do. You've been asleep for so long."
"Jackie, you're not answering my question.
Remember when I said I thought I knew someone who could help you?"
"Yes, and I told you I didn't need any help."
"But she can help you. She helped me and Rolf, and it was the same kind of help you need now."
"What are you talking about? She's a killer."
"Scott, listen to me. During the last election, there were some threats against Rolf. Claudia works with the federal attorney's office. She was part of the investigation into the threats and helped arrange security for us. We spent a lot of time together. You can trust her."
Scott stared at Claudia.
"Jackie, I want you to trust me. There is absolutely no way this woman is on our side."
"Scott, you're delirious. You haven't moved since last night when I came in to pick up your tray."
"Jack, I'm okay,"
Harvath said, as he pushed himself up into a sitting position with two pillows propped behind his back.
"I was gone all night. I got back early this morning and was exhausted. I guess I was so out of it I didn't hear you come into the room."
"And wherever you were," began Claudia, "I assume that's where you got this," referring to Herman's gun.
"Hold it just a second," said Scott, as Jackie offered him a glass of juice. "I'm going to be the one asking questions here, okay? Being held at gunpoint by the same person twice in less than 24 hours allows me that privilege. So first, who the hell are you?"
"You've already been told that. I'm Claudia Mueller of the Federal Attorney's Office."
"And you just happened to be up at the Ice Palace yesterday at the same time I was, and just happened to stick a gun in my back, and just happened to have two men with you who tried to kill me?"
"I had nothing to do with the men who were shooting at us in the Ice Palace."
"Us? What do you mean?"
"You do understand English, don't you?"
"Enough to get by," he replied smugly.
"I mean," said Claudia, who ignored Scott's sarcasm, "they were shooting at us, you and me. I have no idea who they were."
"And you probably have no idea about who was then shooting at me in Wengen, only an hour later."
"I know one thing. It wasn't the men from the Ice Palace."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because those two were still at the Jungfraujoch an hour later."
"How do you know?"
Scott asked as he continued to look her over. She was gorgeous, but he couldn't shake his first impression of her. Funny how a gun jammed in your back could do that.
"I know because I was there too. I was trying to find you while avoiding them. It wasn't easy. I don't know how you managed to slip away. You must be quite clever."
"I have my days, but yesterday sure wasn't one of them. Someone else managed to find me, and they turned Wengen into a shooting gallery. I was lucky to get away with only this."
Harvath pointed to his left arm and noticed that a small amount of blood had seeped through the bandage. He started to unravel it, but Jackie quickly sat down next to him and took over.
"Do you have any idea who it was that tried to shoot at you in Wengen?"
"They weren't trying to shoot at me. They actually were shooting at me. And besides, I said I would ask the questions here. What were you doing at the Ice Palace in the first place, and why did you pull a gun on me?"
"You know what, guys?
I have a ton of stuff to get done, said Jackie. I think I'm going to leave you two alone.
Catching the look in Scott's eyes, she added,
Don't worry. You'll be perfectly safe with Claudia. She's extremely tough. She climbs mountains in her spare time for fun. Did you know that?
Beckoning to Claudia, she said,
Why don't you finish changing this dressing for me? There's only been a little bleeding, but the stitches are still intact. It looks like he'll mend. Another toughie. You two will get along fine.
Getting up, Jackie patted the place on the bed where she'd been sitting next to Scott. Claudia stood up and set the guns from her lap onto the chair and made her way to the bed. She took a roll of clean gauze from Jackie and began wrapping Scott's arm. Jackie closed the door behind her.
As I said, I work for the Federal Attorney's Office in Bern, which is called the Bundesanwaltschaft. I was following a suspect in an ongoing investigation who had been using a post office box in Interlaken.
Wait a second. Are you or are you not Aunt Jane?
I am not.
Then what the hell were you doing at the Ice Palace?
I think I can make the situation somewhat clearer, if you'll allow me.
Be my guest.
Once a week, my suspect travels to the post office to check for mail. He is a creature of habit, typical Swiss. Very methodical, and always comes on the same day at normally the same time. So I have a certain window in which I know I can check the box to see if he has received anything that might help me in tying him to my case.
Tying him to your case? Is he a suspect or not?
I haven't been able to gather enough evidence yet, but I know he is somehow involved. I have what you Americans refer to, I believe, as a hunch.
Yes, hunch is the correct word, but that's legal in Switzerland, reading someone's mail? Please, not so tight on the bandage.
I know what I am doing, Agent Harveth.
How do you know who I am?
Which question should I answer first?
She said, giving Scott a little slack in his dressing before taping the gauze in place.
Lady's choice.
Pardon me?
It means you choose, lady.
I see. Like my suspect, I am also somewhat methodical, and of course I'm Swiss, so I'll take your questions in order. As far as the legality of investigating the suspect's mail, it depends upon the severity of the charge and the investigator. And as for knowing who you are, Jackie told me everything.
Everything?
She cares about you a great deal and is very worried about you. Don't be upset with her. She did the right thing in calling me. I was just as shocked to see you lying in that bed as you were to see me. I thought you had brought those two men to the Ice Palace to kill me.
You? Why would I do that?
Why does anyone commit murder? I'm sure the motivations are no different in Switzerland than they are in America. All I know is that after I picked up what I think I can correctly assume was your letter from the post box, I noticed I was being followed. I engaged in an evasive tactic.
Crossing to the bakery?
Yes. And then I secluded myself in a doorway and waited. As it turns out, I was more patient than you were.
In the Ice Palace, you called me by the name I had used in the post office, and by my real name. How did you figure those out?
Wait. The Sampras one is the easiest. You went back to the post office and asked if anyone had seen someone matching my description.
You are quite charming, Agent Harveth. The woman at the poste-restante window remembered you perfectly. She also had your alias written down on a piece of paper to check for your envelope, which still hasn't come, by the way.
I have to tell her not to hold her breath.
I already did. She was quite disappointed she wouldn't be seeing you again. Now, as far as getting your real name, that was a little more difficult. I had seen you on the street, but was able to get a better look at your face from the post office surveillance tape. The female clerk told me you were American. So I went back to my office and started doing some searches on the computer, starting with our watch list. Two names had recently been added, a German and an American. The description of the American sounded like it could fit you. I emailed a request to the authoring agency and not long after received a picture of you. The hair is quite different, of course, but that only made it more obvious.
Authoring agency? What do you mean by you emailed them a request?
They are the people who put your name on our watch list. Sometimes it's an Interpol request, sometimes it's a local or federal Swiss agency, sometimes it's another country. There is often a wide array of agencies who add to a watch list for a wide variety of reasons. I know about watch lists, thank you very much. What I want to know is, who put me on yours? It was an American agency, of course.
Yes, it was your State Department.
The man who called me mentioned...
Called you?
Who called you?
After I requested the picture, I received a phone call. A man identified himself as being from a particular division of the State Department and said that he was responding to my email request for your photo. He asked me a lot of questions and was frankly not very polite.
What did you tell him?
Basically, I told him nothing. I said we had a lot of ongoing investigations involving tourist crimes and I wondered if you might somehow be involved. I wanted your picture so I could compare it against some recent witness descriptions we had received in several resort areas.
And you didn't tell them you had seen me, or thought you had seen me?
No. I told them exactly what I just told you. Of course, he reminded me several times about informing them immediately if I even thought I had seen you, and not to try and intercept you.
But you had seen me. Why didn't you say something?
I didn't say anything because if the U.S. State Department wanted you that bad, and you were somehow associated with the case I was investigating, then I wanted you as well. I have been waiting for a break in this case. I'm certainly not going to sit back and turn it over to the Americans. No offense.
None taken. But I think you did turn it over.
What do you mean?
Was the German added to your watch list at the same time?
It was listed in the same update, which meant they had been both added in the same time period, yes.
Do you remember the name of the German?
I think it was something like Brunner, but I don't remember exactly. At the time, it wasn't important. I'm normally pretty good with names, but I was so focused on you and what your involvement was and is.
Could it have been Browner?
It could have been. Yes, it was. Hans. Hans Browner. I knew I would remember it.
Harvath put his head in his hands and massaged his temples.
Can you be absolutely certain you were not followed here today?
Followed? Why?
Just answer me, please, said Scott.
After I finally evaded the two men from the Jungfraujoch, I was extremely cautious, even paranoid. I am positive no one followed me here. Why?
I think I finally know how the shooters in Wengen picked up my trail.
Picked up your trail? Who are they?
They're an American hit team that tried twice to kill me in Washington several days ago.
How did they track you here? Have you been using your real name to travel?
What am I, new? Please, Miss Mueller, I don't know how the Swiss do things, but trust me, we Americans are a lot more thorough than that.
So are we Swiss, Agent Harvath. But the only way someone who doesn't want to be found gets found is if they make some sort of mistake.
Or if someone tips off the people looking for you, which is what I'm afraid you did quite unknowingly.
Me?
Yes. When you sent that email asking for my picture, it started a whole chain of events. When I left the U.S., I was traveling as Hans Browner. So the people who were after me had enough pull to get both my real name and my false one put on your watch list in case I turned up. Just asking for the picture was enough to make someone suspect that you knew more than you were telling. My guess is that as soon as they had figured out I was Browner and had come to Switzerland, they sent a hit team over here. They got both the names on the watch list, and then it was just a waiting game. When you sent your email, it got people thinking, and they decided to tail you. Either they didn't see me follow you from the post office, or they hadn't begun to tail you until you went to the Jungfraujoch the next day.
But what about your letter? After I resealed it, I put it back in the post office box. Maybe I am not being followed at all. Maybe your letter drew the shooters. That was your intent, wasn't it? Someone was supposed to read that letter and be sufficiently interested to show up, right? Why were you setting up a meeting at the Ice Palace in the first place? And what do you know about Aunt Jane?
At this point, not enough. I do know, though, that our paths have crossed for a reason, and I intend to figure out why. We need to talk more, you and me, but not here.
Then where?
Someplace else, anywhere else. Having you here has made me realize how much danger I've already put Jackie in. She's too much of a good friend. We need to find someplace safe where we can sort this all out.
I think I have just the place.
62. Just the place,
turned out to be the nearby elegant yet vacant summer residence of Claudia's boss, Urs Schnell, which they unceremoniously gained entrance to when Claudia kicked in one of the small windows in back.
"Okay,"
said Scott, taking a pen and pad from the ornate desk in the far corner of the living room and walking back to Claudia at the fireplace.
"Let's get started. Why don't we begin with your investigation? What's it all about? Who are you following, etc.?"
"That would be fine, except that is classified information, and I am bound by my oath to..."
"What? Are you saying you don't trust me?"
"I hardly know you."
"Hold it. A little over 24 hours ago, you had a gun jammed into my spine, yet here I am alone and defenseless with you."
Claudia gave him a look that said, "You, defenseless?"
"Okay, I'm not defenseless, but I am here, and you did have a gun on me yesterday. I mean, why else would I come to a deserted love nest with you and lock myself inside for the evening?"
Again, Claudia shot him a look.
"Okay, you're not that bad looking, but I am not going to let that get in the way of some other mildly important things, like saving my life and the president's."
"You're right. I'm sorry,"
said Claudia, becoming more businesslike.
"We need to work together. Our two cases seem to merge based on who sends and receives letters via the postbox in Interlaken."
As Claudia shared the details of her case with Scott, he took copious notes that would be tossed into the fire once they both had looked them over and digested the information. Hours passed, and they ate from the bags of food they had purchased on the way to the house. When the bottle of mineral water was finished, they moved to a bottle of wine. It was a nice white, a Côte du Ricin, from just outside Geneva. Claudia bent her own rule about drinking while she was working. Scott liked the wine and laughed when Claudia explained that the reason he couldn't find any Swiss wines back home was that Switzerland didn't export wines, it imported drinkers. That reminded him of something, but he couldn't remember what. His mind was still not firing on every cylinder. He let it go, figuring if it was important, it would come back. He drank his wine slowly and looked down at the pages of notes spread out on the floor before them.
"So let's go over what we know. Senator Snyder, according to the documents I received from Andre Martin, wrote a letter to someone he called Aunt Jane, signed it with the name Edwin, and mailed it to the post office box in Interlaken. The box is owned, or at least used, by this man, Gerhard Meiner, whom you've been trying to link to your investigation of the weapons theft from a depot outside of Basel. How am I doing?"
"So far, so good," she said.
"Because of Meiner's involvement with this group,
Nebel, it means fog in German."
"Right, fog. So, Meiner, many years ago, after cross-training with U.S. Special Operations Forces, returns to Switzerland and establishes this unit which is designed to test the security of Swiss military installations. He's so successful with breaching security at the bases that he quickly earns a lot of enemies, and his unit is shut down for fear of embarrassing the military establishment, and he is moved higher in your intelligence sector."
"Yes."
Scott paused, tapping the pen against his chin.
"I can see why you suspected him. He certainly has the credentials. What about the weapons? What can you tell me about those?"
"It depends. Which weapons in particular do you want to know about?"
He looked at the notes he'd taken.
"A lot of what you've described is standard military hardware. Because the Swiss never had in their possession a jamming device, that item isn't part of the theft you're investigating. The kidnappers I'm looking for could have purchased it on the black market or directly from the North Koreans. What stands out on your list are the glare guns. Tell me about those."
"They were Russian issue. Dostov was the name of the company that created them. There are two in the Basel depot. They were brand new, and the army hadn't even had a chance to fully test them yet. The manufacturer had only produced a limited number and was loaning them to different governments in hopes that they could create large-scale orders for the device. These were the prototypes, in a sense. So even if an individual wanted to buy them, they weren't available for sale."
"What were you planning to use them for?"
"At this stage, I don't think we planned on using them for anything. My government had acquired them strictly to test their effectiveness."
"Effectiveness against what?"
"Switzerland is a relatively peaceful country, despite your experience in the Jungfrau," Claudia said with a smile. As such, we have been looking into a series of non-lethal weapons. Over the next 2 years, we will be hosting several high-profile economic and diplomatic summits. After the WTO and World Bank disturbances the USA experienced, we decided we needed to be better prepared to handle civil unrest.
But why the Russians? Why buy equipment from them when we have a very strong alliance with your country and are developing similar technology?
From what I understand, your testing of non-lethal laser weapons has not been very successful. The Russians seem to have it more finely tuned. Also, I have no idea if this is a technology that the Americans are sharing. Besides, we were only going to test it. We had not yet decided if we were going to buy it.
So this shipment of weapons arrives at the Basel Depot, and before your people get a chance to use it, it's stolen. How did the thieves know it was coming and where it would be?
We suspect there was a leak.
Could Miner have had access to this information?
Yes, and knowing this, he had both a motive and the means. Motive was easy, money. I tried to check his alibi, but he claims he was working on a classified assignment at the time of the theft.
What about his superiors? This guy has to answer to someone.
He's very clever. Whatever he was up to, he had his tracks well covered.
It looks that way.
What is it about the glare guns that interests you so much?
You know, for the longest time, I've been wondering how one of the finest protective details in the world could be ambushed and killed with only one man getting a shot off.
You are referring to your president's team?
Yes. It didn't make sense to me until I began thinking about the glare guns. If Miner is connected to the president's kidnapping, and he brought the glare guns with him, I can see how the Secret Service agents were taken out. Blinded and disoriented, they wouldn't have been able to safely evacuate the president or take any shots.
But what?
How did one of the agents get a shot off and manage with that one shot to kill a bad guy?
Maybe he wasn't as affected as the other agents?
Or maybe that's just what somebody wanted us to think.
What do you mean by that?
It never sat well with me that the kidnappers would leave one of their own behind. I also never liked it that this guy was found holding a gun that directly tied him to where he was from. For such a carefully planned assault, it seems very careless and therefore very suspicious.
If the one body was left at the scene on purpose, what does that say?
It says that somebody really wanted us to believe that a Middle Eastern group was behind the kidnapping.
And what about the demands of the FRC, said Claudia.
What about them? Scott thought. Today was Sunday, a week since the avalanche. He had been on the run since Wednesday. Just 4 days, but it felt like a lifetime. America might already have caved in by now, or a whole new set of demands could have been made. All he knew he got from looking at an occasional newspaper. The vice president was refusing to deal, and the president had not yet been returned.
That's a big question mark. Everything points away from a Mideastern organization except the demands, said Harbath.
Maybe who committed the kidnapping and who paid for it are two separate groups.
That's the direction I am taking, and it's the only thing that could explain the Fatah's involvement. So, if you find one of the groups, you should be able to find the other.
What else do we have?
Well, we have the two shooters in the ice palace speaking Serbian, and my source's confirmation of a Swiss assassination team working in Yugoslavia in recent years.
And they called themselves the Lions, right?
Yes. Does that mean anything to you?
Kind of. But it's really just a feeling.
Coming to Switzerland was just a feeling for me. But with every gun that gets jabbed in my back, or bullet that whizzes past my head, I'm learning to trust my feelings even more, so please, share.
Well, when you first mentioned the Lions, it made me think of words like proud and arrogant. Those words remind me of Gerhard Meiner.
The lunch you had with him?
Yes, which seems silly, but there was another picture that came to mind when you talked about the assassination team being Swiss and being named the Lions. There is a very famous monument in Lucerne of a dying lion. It was carved out of a rock ledge as a tribute to the men of the Swiss Guard who died defending King Louis and Marie Antoinette during the Revolution.
You think there might be some sort of symbolic connection?
Why not? Switzerland has always been proud of its neutrality, but also very proud of the ferocity and courage of its mercenaries. Ferocity and courageousness, just like a lion.
This monument is in Lucerne?
Yes,